It is the best of the Bob McCallum podcast, yours truly, along with John Shannon.
Happy holidays, Bob.
Same to you. Hope everybody's ready for the big weekend. We spend most of our time, of course, talking about sports, but every once in a while we veer a little off the path. And so today, George Strombolopoulos, well known to most people across Canada and in the United States, comedian, actor Jerry D, and the longtime host of The National on CBC, Peter Mansbridge. Pretty eclectic group.
And they all like sports. So when we invite them, they come on and they want to talk sports. We want to talk news.
Well, you get a bit of both, I think, in this one. So Strombo, Jerry D, Peter Mansbridge, this time on the Best of the Bob McCallum podcast. Although it's probably
hold on, hold on. Cents. We got a raise.
Let me turn these lights off.
I knew. Look, oh geez. Hey, yeah, that'd be better. That'd be better.
Our lighting director at work today. That's good.
That's right. Joining us is a longtime pal and somebody you will know well, Jerry Donahue. Oh, are we supposed to even say that?
We're not supposed to say that, are we? That's my birth name.
Yeah, I know that. You didn't officially change it, though, did you?
No. Which causes problems sometimes when I don't have ID with that name on it.
So tell the story. You've walked in some place, and you have your ID all says Donahue on it, and people go, "Oh, it's Jerry D." Well, where's your ID? This is not you.
Yeah. Pretty much. Seriously. And because we're Canadian celebrities, no one really knows us. So
I was going to say, that's an oxymoron.
That's exactly what it is. Canadian celebrity. We don't say American celebrity.
Now, Jerry, do you remember the last time you and I connected? Do you remember the last time?
No, I don't remember the last time.
Cabot Links. You were walking off the ninth, and right. I was walking onto the 10th or something like that at Cabot.
Right.
And I keep telling McCowan that he couldn't take it at Cabot because he had to walk 18 holes. Because it is something, isn't it?
It's the best.
Well, look, I have a golf cart here in the house. I take a golf cart from here in my office to the bathroom.
Yeah, you get a caddy, Bob. They'll give you a caddy.
I don't care about a caddy. Well, has the caddy got a cart?
Nope.
No. Well, then
you gotta walk.
Then I ain't playing. I take a cart around the house. I don't walk anywhere. I've walked for a long time. I'm done with walking. Winter and walking, two things I hate.
You gotta go. We'll go get you a scooter or something. You gotta go check it out.
it is quite the place. Now, do you have a preference of the courses? Do you like the original or do you like the Cliffs?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Cliffs has a bit more of that, you know, once you get around the 16th hole, more of that like postcard look. But the Lynx, yeah, I think would be more of a challenge. I think if you would have a pro tournament there, I think the Lynx would probably go over. I don't know. It's hard to tell. They're both amazing. They're just unbelievable.
I've been every year until this year when they wouldn't allow us to go.
Yeah, I'm going in July. I'm going. I'm trying to make it a Canada Day weekend thing every time. We hope.
Yeah.
So a bunch of things to talk to you about. You're busy with Family Feud now.
Yes.
You're not touring anymore, obviously, because of COVID, right?
No, correct.
So, are you still shooting the series?
No, we got them done as quickly as we could. We wrapped end of November, I think, around end of November. So we did five a day. We like to do four a day. We did five a day because, you know, you never know what's coming, right, with the shutdowns. Right. And we got through it. So they're all in the bank. They're all airing. A lot of fun, way harder without an audience. There's nothing like trying to be funny with no audience. So
yeah,
that was, but I got used to it. And, you know, I was thankful we were shooting, so I wasn't going to complain about no audience.
Well, so it looks easy to do a game show. Is it easy to do a game show?
It's a good question. I'm not going to say it's hard. The hard part is if it's just a game show, I don't think you're going to watch it for very often. It's trying to find the, you know, for me, the humor, and that's not easy because you're got 2 seconds. But hosting a game show, is it hard? No, I'm not going to say it's hard, but I think when you try to make it your own and add an element of comedy, which is what I think half of the show is, that part will be hard. Yeah.
Did you watch Richard Dawson tapes? Did you watch Steve Harvey? Yeah. Did you watch any of the other guys that did it?
I did. I watched, you know, I grew up watching Dawson. So Ray Coombs was probably the one for me that turned the corner on the show. Well, Richard Dawson was great. I mean, aside from the kissing, which is really hard to watch, you know, you get a father and then he introduces Richard to his 23-year-old daughter. And I got two daughters. I'm like, yeah, that's not weird. But Ray Coombs, I think, did some real funny stuff. And I think Steve Harvey's the best. So I did. I watched episodes of all of them just to see their, you know, their flavor. But at the end of the day, I just wanted to make it my own. And, you know, I've got a long way to go to get better at it. But that's fine. It's our second year we just shot, so.
So Canadians are always depicted as being so polite and in that way, kind of un-American. So compare the contestants, the families that you're dealing with what you see when you watch the US version. Same, different, more polite, harder to get a laugh out of them, what?
Yeah. See, I get that asked in my stand-up that, you know, the American audience is different. I mean, I guess this connotation that we're polite has stuck with us. I've met a lot of assholes in Canada too. So it's you know, I've met a lot of great Americans. So the difference to me is we don't go blue on the show. We don't go that a lot of sex humor.
Right.
So that would be the big difference. I the families to me, you know, you get a family from Newfoundland or Alberta and Quebec, and you get the diversity we have in the country that's what makes it special for me is knowing the country so well, cause I've traveled it. I think that brings an element that's different from the States. But I think for me, I want bad answers. I want really bad answers. So,
well, that's funnier, right?
But the families are honestly, this is their 15 minutes of fame. The money, sure, it's important to them, but they are so excited and their energy. If I've met 200 families, there has not been one that hasn't been awesome. And that's a testament to the casting and everything they do behind the scenes, but they're just so excited. You know, I hear them talking before I come out on stage. I'm in the green room watching to see who I'm going to deal with. And they're like, wow, look at that. Our name's on it. You know, it's, oh my God, this is so cool. Like these are grown men and women. And I can relate to that. Cause I was that guy too. When I started, you know, my first TV, anything. So I can appreciate their excitement every time they're there. And I try to remember that. Cause I can, you know, I can go hard sometimes, like if their answer's so bad, I got to be careful.
Other than Red Bull and black coffee, how do you maintain your energy between show 1 and 5?
Coffee. I don't do Red Bull. Coffee. You know, it's a good question. And I guess my answer is it's my job. And if I look, you know, I'm easily replaceable. If I become a guy that fades after, you know, the third episode, that's going to show in my performance. And I always look at it like that. Like, I'm lucky to have this job. There's, you know, these families are as excited to be here as the first families of the day. I got to give them the same energy. It's the same as a stand-up tour. If I'm at the 10th date, you know, of a 10 city run, I got to remember that they're paying a lot of money. They're getting a babysitter. It's a night out. And I got to remember that. And I do that. I never want to mail it in because I just don't think that's fair or professional. So where does the energy come from? Just the fact that I remind myself that I'm really lucky to do this. Don't get complacent. As we all know, you can be replaced very quickly in this world.
Oh, really?
You're telling us, Jerry?
That wasn't a segue, but...
Yeah, thanks, D.
Yes, yeah, there you go.
Nice. Nice shot.
it's true. It's the same for all of us.
Oh, we know it's true, pal.
You just moved on, not replaced.
Yeah, right. So, so you and I ran into each other the first time when you were working over at the Score and doing all those, goofy things, mm-hmm. sports-related goofy things. And then you start doing stand-up, and then Mr. D comes along, and that becomes a hit in Canada. And we're going to get to it later because now it's about to explode in the U.S., we think. And now you're doing a game show. And not to... not to diminish the significance of what you're doing right now, but I wonder if you had, after doing Mr. D, did you have any second thoughts about taking this show when it was offered to you?
No, zero. It was a real quick yes. I got the phone call. Mr. D, I decided to end that after 8 seasons. I felt, well, we're going to drive this in the ground and you want to keep it creatively funny. And then I had this bit like, now what? Holy cow. And I created a couple new shows on paper and, they were in development and then never greenlit and met with all the networks. And, obviously I'm really tight with CBC and they've been great to me. And yeah, I just got this call out of the blue from Sally and, I was very excited. It's an iconic show.
Sure it is.
I knew there was room to play and make it my own. So no, it was a real quick yes. And they could have asked a lot of people. I mean, you really can in our entertainment world. There's a lot of people. And I was really lucky that I got asked. So it was a quick yes. I love it. It's so fun to do. It's not like a sitcom. I was directing and writing and acting and producing, and it was a lot of hats.
That's work.
Yeah, it was a lot of hats. This one, I go in, I host, I don't have any of that responsibility. And, I love that. So I still want to do a sitcom. I'm still creating shows and pitching them and maybe I'll do another one, maybe not. I mean, it's really, really hard to get a sitcom in Canada. And even because I've had one, it doesn't make it any easier because I've had a lot of no's since then.
So you go on set now with Feud and it's ad lib. I'm sure almost none of it is scripted.
None of it.
And
just
I'm sure
the questions.
And I'm just sure you, yeah well, of course, questions. But you're reading those. I'm sure you ad-libbed a lot in Mr. D too, but that's a scripted series.
Yeah.
And you've got to sit down and memorize your lines. Mm-hmm. Is that functionally why do you think that Feud feels simpler to you, easier for you to do? Because you don't have that behind the scenes.
Sure. Prepping, of course, it's like for sure, prepping is a lot. There's no prep for me on Family Feud other than I'll read over the families, I'll get some tidbits on them, but the prep on Mr. D started 6 months ahead. I worked with a great group of writers and directors, and it was great, but it was a lot more prep. And then rewriting scripts, we would go do that, and then memorizing lines. And so no question. I mean, I go in, I learn a bit about the families. I might have a couple of bullet points on the monitor to remind me, and away we go. And it's fun because I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, with this year we had a guy, one question, name something you eat that's frozen. And, you know, I get there's pressure and they're, and he said, cat. I mean, you can't write that. And he what? And then he just went, oh, like he, so he must've heard a different question or, and you try, I get it. Right. But the poor guy got roasted. Right. And,
First by you.
Well, not really, John, because the game is so structured in such a format for many, many years that I can't spend a lot of time with him because I'm giving her more time to think.
Ah, right.
And that's constantly said to me, like, right. you can't ask a question to one team and then talk about the answer for 6 seconds, 20 seconds, because they're thinking while they're waiting. So yeah. I didn't get to do much. Of course, we had the girl that said Popeye's favorite food. She said chicken. That went viral. That's really was really good for the show. But you can't write this.
Bob touched about Mr. D going to Amazon Prime. Congratulations.
Yes.
From my observation, is this the Schitt's Creek effect? Are the Americans finding Canadian humor finally, or is it just the need for content?
I think the latter. I wish it was. I mean, what Schitt's Creek did was phenomenal. It was, you know, we're all wishing that would happen to our shows here. This was a very late play for us. We had, for whatever reason, been passed on by, you know, some Netflixes and Hulu and stuff. We weren't getting what we wanted in the US, and that's the market you want to hit. And then it just goes international. But to be fair, our show is very, it's got its edge. There's no real heart. There's no real love interests. It's just pure out British style comedy because my family's British, and it's just, we try to make it laugh out loud moments. So it's not for everyone. So we're there now, but it's not like we're a highlighted show on Amazon Prime where they're marketing us. They're, you know, I'm literally marketing it myself and hired a company and we're going to give it a go. But now the Schitt's Creek effect might help people watch it because they heard it's another Canadian comedy from CBC. But, you know, I was asked if I wanted to advertise it that way. And I said, no, I said, that's not fair to Schitt's Creek to try to grab onto their, you know, their coattails. But, you know, we're proud of what they did. And it certainly helps Canadian comedy for sure.
So now what, D? No, you know, I mean, I know the feud thing is great, and it's a living and probably a pretty good one. But I know it doesn't take up all your day.
Yeah.
And your mind works all the time, and you can't do stand up right now. So you can't be on tour. What else you got on the fire, and what kind of show are you trying to stick to sitcoms, or do you aspire to do something, I don't know, more serious?
Yeah, I wrote a drama with a wonderful writer who's a dramatist. And it was in development. It was called Hockey Dreams. And really what it was is, you know, as you may know, I coached AAA hockey in Tier 2 for many years. And then I switched into stand-up and have a lot of love for the game and coached, you know, many years. And I wanted to write a drama about minor hockey in Canada that was done properly, because we've tried these shows in the past that, and I would watch, I'm like, that's not what happens. And you know, it was the same with Mr. D. We wanted to get it authentic. So, but hockey is a hard sell for networks for some reason. I don't get it. They love the script. It was, you know, I had four families on a team. You have your, you know, your lower socioeconomic family, your rich kid, and all the stories we know in minor hockey. And I knew them very well because I lived them. And so that was my first attempt. But these, you know, a lot of these networks want a U.S. partner, and the U.S. don't really catch on to hockey shows. So that was the first attempt at drama. And right now I'm in the process of pitching another comedy, and I've pitched a few, and I've got a movie that I'm writing and that are comedy. So I do want to try drama as an actor and as a writer, and, but you know, I know comedy is my strength. And so, like you said, I'm, you know, my daughter is probably, she probably doesn't love it, but she's a high level golfer. And so I probably spend too much time with her on that. She's probably like, oh God. So, you know, we hit balls a lot, and she's got a coach now, and she's getting really good. So I'm, you know, like you said, when I go at something, I go hard at it, which is probably not good for her, but I've tried to kind of leave her alone now and guide her as best I can.
How old is she?
I can't.
She's 13.
All right. So she's got time to develop, and
yeah.
Well, she's got a better swing than you, Jerry. She's got a better
she's
swing. Got,
yeah. She's probably beats me now, which is, I didn't think it would happen. You know, she'll break 80 from 6,000 yards, which is
wow.
The women's amateur length. And she hits it about 240 now. And so she's got all the tools. It's just time will tell. Right. So
how about a sitcom about an afternoon drive radio guy that, you know, just, you know, can't make it work. You know?
Well, I'm working on a sitcom right now that encompasses what you all do and what I did as a, you know, in that sports reporter world. So I'm really hoping, and that's where I'll draw upon characters like you guys and people I've met that, you know, we know from when I worked at the Score, there's characters in every world, and there's no different in the sports world. So I'm hoping that starts to get something, but that's the kind of the latest thing I'm working on.
We're thrilled to be joined by our friend and longtime colleague, the former voice of news in this country on CBC. Peter Mansbridge is with us. You look beautiful. Are you in Stratford?
I am in Stratford, and it's good to be with both you and John today, Bob. It's great to talk to you.
Over the last while, through COVID and now through the escalation of the Black Lives Matter movement, do you miss that opportunity every night to talk to this country?
Sometimes I miss it a bit, but nowhere near as much as I thought I might miss it. You know, there's a need for change in a lot of things. And you know, those who've had the roles that I've had, you've had, and John's had, those change over time. And we're still involve ourselves in the conversation, you know, as best we can. But you know, the media landscape has changed so much. Being the anchor of the network news is not what it used to be.
Of course not.
You know, I always put it, you know, I tend to put it in the American perspective, because it's easier to make it sound this way instead of using Canadian personalities. But let's say, you know, forget about the Cronkite years. Go to the next level when it was Brokaw and Jennings and Rather. You could go out on the street in New York or Los Angeles or, you know, Wichita, Kansas, and say, who are the three anchors of the network news? And people will say, well, of course, you know, it's Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings and Dan Rather. Everybody knew that. Mm-hmm. You'd try that today?
No
chance.
You'd
be lucky to get one of the three names right.
Yep.
Because there are there's so much more than three. And people's
Lester Holt, Nora O'Donnell, and David Muir.
Okay, give that man a ice cream cone. That's very good.
Oh, yeah. Hey,
there's one thing that hasn't changed, Peter, and that is your beloved Toronto Maple Leafs. So we have to get your thought on your beloved Toronto Maple Leafs before.
Well, they're not even playing Shannon, for God's sakes, which is not an unusual thing.
Which is
since 1967, for God's sake.
I didn't realize you'd change your name to Peter, Bob.
Well, let me answer the question this way. you know, like a lot of other Leaf fans, I was very disappointed by the way things unfolded. And although I will forever remember that game four in the last 3 minutes. That was the most excitement around a Leaf game I've seen in decades. And that was a treasure. So at least they gave us that. But I was disappointed, and I firmly believed, and I think Kyle Dubas is starting to show the indications of this as well, that there are going to be a lot of people, a lot of players who were wearing blue and white in this year who won't be back next year. And I think that's needed. I think there needs to be some change. To me, there's only one person who's not tradable, and that's Austin, but that's just me. However, let me make this point about the Leafs, and it's got nothing to do with the Leafs. You know, I watched the game the other night between the Islanders and
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, right. And I watched those two teams playing, and I thought, there's no way the Leafs could be on this ice. They're just not that good. They're nowhere near as good as either one of those two teams. And if they're ever going to make it, they got to get as good as those two. And those two may not even make it to the finals. So, you know, there's change needs to happen in Toronto. I'm not saying throw everything out, but there's clearly got to be some change. And, you know, we know where the problems are. They've been the same problems we've had for years. Team's not big enough. Team doesn't have defense. And there's something. I don't blame as much on. I get mad at Freddie Anderson when he lets the big goal in the big game, but guy's got no defense. Give him a break.
You know, I love getting management going on this one. I love getting them going on this stuff.
Well, I hate to tell you lug nuts the truth, but this is the same conversation that the three of us probably would have had 52 years ago and every year since at this time of year. So this is not a great revelation. I hate to tell you, Mansbridge. They have disappointed us almost annually for 53 consecutive years, and there's no reason to believe that that's going to change anytime soon. Having said that, there's always hope. And, you're sticking to it, I gather, as a Leaf fan.
There's always hope, and there's the Raptors, and they're the Blue Jays. Can you believe the Blue Jays this year?
Isn't it interesting that as we sit here right now, you can be optimistic about the Raptors still, but you can really be optimistic about the Blue Jays, and I'd have bet $1 million. I don't know about you. I'd have bet $1 million against that happening, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I probably would have bet $1 million that the Raptors would, you know, without Kawhi, would not have had the year that
I agree. I agree.
And I remind you of the last season when they were down 2-0 in the round two, and they won it all. So,
a simple answer on the Jays: playing outside. Playing outside helps, you know.
You've lost your mind. What are you talking about? Well, outside.
Playing with real grass and under the lights and sunshine. Come on,
They play 65 games a year outside under any circumstance,
but not at home.
John Shannon from the Buffalo Chamber of Commerce. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Mansbridge. Thank you. Look, the setting looks beautiful. I haven't been to Stratford in several years, but I love the place, and especially love the place at this time of year. Yeah. 4 months from now, when you and your bride are sitting there and the snow is up to here, I'll think about you again and question the wisdom of your decision to move there. But nonetheless, in the summer, there's no place better. Listen, it's lovely to see you. We thank you as always. You've always been generous with your time, and we want you to know we sincerely appreciate it. And hopefully we'll run into you sometime soon.
That's great to talk to you, Bob. Even to talk to John. It's, you know, it's great.
Oh, boy, get on. Another guy on the bandwagon. Appreciate it.
There you go. I'm trying to remember the last time I saw this character. It was some time ago. And I think it's been a while for many people who at least live in Canada, who are certainly familiar with the face and the name, but maybe less familiar with what he's been doing the last little while. George Strombolopoulos joins us. Strombo, you look beautiful.
Hello, gentlemen. Like, lovely. Nice to see you as well. How are you guys doing?
You join us from Los Angeles. I know you, has kind of been a, this has been a place you have been fond of going to for some time now. Yeah. Is this a full-time residency at this point?
No, no, I've been paying rent here for a long time, but I'm usually here when I'm not shooting. This was a nice place to come and have a normal life and develop other projects. And then I'd go back to Toronto. I've been down here for the winter though, since December. I got the old Bobcat Vegas schedule going. So I'm down here and I love it. I love LA. I love the weather. I like to ride motorcycles, but a lot of the work that I do is centered here. So this is why I come down.
And Bob talked about residency. I did think you were talking about Vegas. I mean, you know, you're headlining somewhere, George.
That's right. Well, I work. I do a show for Apple every day, and their studio's out of Culver City, so it's a lot easier to navigate it here.
Did you ride your bike down?
No, not this time. I took the pickup truck, and I got to the border. The border was closed, and I showed up, and the guys at the border looked at me, and they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I need to get to LA." They said, "Why don't you just fly like everybody else?" And I was in this, I had this pretty badass pickup truck. And I said, "Honestly, man, I need this truck. I need the truck down there." And the border guard looked at me and he went, "Cool. Okay, come on in." And so yeah. I gave him my paperwork. I had some visa stuff. They endorsed me and they let me through the border.
Tell us exactly what you've been doing.
So I have a daily music show that I do, an interview show that I do for Apple every day. So it's on Apple Music Hits, it's called. We launched that in August. We've been working on it since January, essentially February. So that's one of the main jobs. And then I run a production company. So we have a feature film, which is coming out this year. It's completed, a couple others in the works. But the daily on-air stuff is I've been doing this music show for Apple for quite a bit.
The other thing is you were on the cutting edge, George, at least more than Bob and me. When it came, you've been on Instagram, you've been running a lot of stuff on a nightly basis, still talking to people that way.
That's right. And you know, what's interesting about those Instagram live streams is I actually started them about 4 years ago when live streams started. And just during the pandemic, I was able to just kind of spend more time with people. And late night starts, I play piano, we take questions, we interview people about how they're feeling, we bring in other guests, but it's really informal, it's really raw, which is what I like about it, right? It's that it's a real conversation. And as you know, when you're on a live stream broadcasting from your phone, you can run the risk of flying too close to the sun. And I quite like that. So when you don't have the studio to keep you in line, you can get in trouble. And I really like dancing on that line. So the live streams have really helped me do that. Keep me sharp.
So basically having no boss is good for you.
I gotta be honest with you, with a few exceptions, I've worked for some really wonderful people who've taught me a lot, with a few exceptions. And so now on the Apple side, they treat me like a partner. And the Instagram side, it's just me and whatever stuff right. I feel like I need to shovel myself out of. So I do like playing with fire, but I have a pretty good experience and skill set to just be honest with people. And if I don't want to be honest with them, I just tell them I'm not going to be honest with you here. And the audience accepts that.
We want to spend some time and talk about your departure from Toronto, which was rather abrupt, at least for us as viewers. George Strombolopoulos is with us on the podcast. We'll do that when we come back after this message. With Strombo, George Strombolopoulos is with us from Greater Los Angeles, California. You were given the role of host of Hockey Night in Canada and in general of the new hockey broadcast. When Rogers took over this for a mere $5.2 billion, it was a your announcement was surprising to a lot of people. The announcement of you taking the role was surprising to a lot of people from the perspective that your history in sports, at least visually, was almost non-existent. You'd done a lot of stuff and had a lot of notoriety, but this was something that you hadn't really dabbled in and maybe hadn't dabbled in since you worked at The Fan. Isn't that right?
That was the last time I was full-time in sports, for sure. Absolutely. I spent a lot of time, you know, being a part of events or being part of special broadcasts. You know, for example, that new Hockey Night in Canada theme, my show did that. Our show ran the campaign to do that. We brought in the musicians. We found the singer. Our whole production team, it was my talk show. We're the ones who found that Hockey Night in Canada theme. So we were a big part of it for, you know, and the storytelling in the country for a long time, but certainly not on television. No, definitely not. People didn't know that.
So explain the genesis of how the conversation even happened. Was it with Keith Pelly? Was it with somebody else?
Yeah, I got a text message from somebody else. So when the Rogers deal was announced, I just like heard it the way everybody else did on social media. And I was still doing the talk show at CBC at the time. And I heard the story and I thought, cool, that'll be interesting. I don't think it's going to work, but that'll be interesting. And they then, so I don't even know what month that was, John, you might remember better than I do, but.
It was the Monday or Tuesday after Grey Cup. So it was late November. Okay,
there you go. So then it was only a couple of weeks later then, when maybe a week or so later, when I got a text message from somebody inside the Rogers world saying, do you want to talk? And I said, sure. I texted them back. And then we met in a hotel lobby in Toronto where they were really worried about being spotted with me. And we talked just sort of in a very cursory way about would I be interested in coming over. And then, you know, from there, then there was a conversation with Keith Pelly. Then there was a conversation with Gary. And I kind of said the same thing to them that I said to myself. I'll do it, but I don't think you guys want this. You guys don't, I, to be honest with you, just never thought that they had the stomach for what it would take to do it right. And they're like, no, we want it. And I could tell. And then, so then I was like, you know what, this isn't going to work, but I know that I could do this. Because, and here's the thing, Bob, which is, it's one thing to, and I said this to one of the guys who worked there at the time. Yes, I may be new in hockey, but I might be the most experienced host to ever take over Hockey Night in Canada. Like, I'm a grown-ass person who's done this a long time. As a host, I've done a lot of stuff, and I can host a show. If you want me to be a hockey analyst, no. But if you want an experienced host, sure, I can do it. And I said to them, look, my first choice is to watch Ron McLean do Hockey Night in Canada. But if he's not going to be the guy, then I want it to be me. So I'll take the job. But I went in with open eyes. I knew what this was going to be.
The other thing in this, George, you had already created, almost by osmosis, a really good relationship with people within the NHL. You had been around award shows. You had been around big events. You know, the people in New York were very familiar with your work, which was a huge asset to you, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was. But I think it was organic in that, and it was very natural because I didn't want to work with, I didn't want to work in the system. I was very, and I think they like this about me. I told them that they're falling behind. Like, I think that the broadcast, sports broadcast, is not keeping up with where the culture is going. You watch this happen during the George Floyd Black Lives Matter situation. You watch, like, most sports broadcasters fell apart and networks fell apart in trying to handle that. Most did. Hockey was light years behind. But I didn't say that in a bad way to them. I was just saying that I think the kind of broadcasting that I want to do and where I think we need to go. And they just liked that I was up front with them. But I do like them as people. I like Gary a lot. I like John Collins a lot. And we got along really well. But it was never designed to work in hockey. That was never part of the plan. Like, I didn't think that was going to happen.
Do you think you were dealt a fair deal?
You know, I never, to be honest, if I'm being honest with you, I don't think about this in the context of fair at all. I knew what I was getting into. I knew that if they let me do the thing that they told me they wanted me to do, not only could we have made it work, but I knew pretty quickly that they probably weren't going to do it. But I also wasn't really worried about fear. So I don't worry about fear because, you know what, I signed up, I signed a contract. We made an agreement. Everything went the way I thought it would go. It was 1 year shorter than I thought it would be. I thought we'd probably get 3 years, but that didn't bother me. So I don't think it was unfair. I just think it was.
You know, George, I'll remind you of one thing. You and I were at the draft in South Florida, And I was actually, I became your chauffeur because we didn't really want to travel with anybody else. So it was you and me in the car most of the time, back and forth from the arena. And we had one of those great conversations about where it needed to go and what it needed to be. And you were, this was, you actually had already done your last broadcast at Hockey Night by now. You didn't know that yet. But you were quite confident that the things that you had envisioned for the show were going to be the right things.
Well, you know what it was, John? It was actually the year before. So it was, I had one more season to go. Because I remember that when I'd finished my Stanley Cup final game, I suspected that I didn't think it was going to come back. And then I got the call saying, hey, you don't need to come to the draft, but it wasn't just me. They were changing up the system. But so we had one more year. I knew I had a very clear vision of where that show should have gone. And I was wondering if we were going to get a shot at it, but behind the scenes with my team, I was very upfront with them. I'm like, and when Keith left to go do whatever it is that Keith does, I was just like, there's no way this is going to last.
So can you, any chance you can share what your vision was for that next go around for you there?
Well, I mean, this wasn't specific so much to Hockey Night, but it was specific to, this was specific to Hockey Night in terms of how I would do it. But where I thought sports broadcasting was wrong, I said, we live in an era where, do you guys swear on this broadcast ever?
Sure.
I'll try not to, but we just live in an era where everybody's so full of shit all the time. And most of the time it's because we're asking them to do things that they can't do. So I remember as a hockey viewer and then working there, I always thought the hockey analysis was so backwards because you're asking people, like if we held them by their record, they're wrong all the time. In that we're going to do, this is what this player needs to do. And then the following week, it was a completely different story. And I understand that that's the human component of sports. But I remember saying we need to reduce the opportunity for people to look stupid and create space where we redefine what sports is. Because sports right now, I think, is in terms of broadcasting there's a lot of just things being wrong, which I just didn't think from my background doing news and journalism was not what you should hang your hat on. But also I thought it's not building the community enough. It's not connecting with enough people, and it's not actually growing in the way that everybody else was growing online and growing in other places. So, I also just looked anecdotally at the people in my life and their kids, and none of them cared about hockey. None of them cared about hockey. And I said, hockey broadcasting has spent a lot of time excluding people. You've got to become inclusive and create storytelling that's inclusive. That's how it should have grown. This is like, this, by the way, was before I even took the show. I remember saying to them, you guys are hyper exclusive. And I had a lot of hockey players, NHLers, tell me they thought Hockey Night Canada was a racist broadcast. Hockey players. And they were telling me that. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. And I wanted to help change that perception. Whether that's true or not is irrelevant. This is just what NHLers were telling me, right? And so I thought that the show needed to become more. I'm not saying that it isn't that now. I'm just saying that's what I wanted to do with it at the time.
Sure.
I look back at my departure occasionally and wonder if I saw it coming. And I didn't. As you look back on it now a few years later, did you see it coming? Did you think you should have seen it coming, your departure?
I knew that I wasn't there for long. I knew that I was there to do a thing that I didn't think, like I said, they had the stomach for. So did I see it coming? I did. I did see it coming, Bob. But I'll say this. I remember trying to figure my own exit strategy. I was trying to figure out my own way out before it happened. So I kind of...
Why, George? You were unhappy?
It wasn't that I was unhappy more. It was just more like I'm at a stage in my career where I want to do things that have that are culturally relevant and have impact and move the conversation forward. And I didn't get the sense that, in fact, I clearly got the sense that that wasn't something that they were that interested in. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, well, so then that's not what I signed up for. But again, I'm not the kind of person who is, I don't begrudge them. I don't think it's unfair. It's just in our business, and I'm very practical about this business, and I have a very 360 view about this business, which was Oh, so a team brought me in to do a thing. That team is no longer the team that was there. Keith had left. And I went, oh, I just know how this works. So now the new group wants a different thing. They wanted a more conservative,
traditional broadcast.
Yeah, totally. And I was trying to explain to them that you have to, traditions have to evolve. But they wanted a thing that I didn't want to do. And so I was like, oh, cool. I signed up to do a thing. You changed the path. This isn't a good fit anymore. So I had no hard feelings toward them. I'm very grown up about it. And I don't agree with a lot of the things they did, but I also don't, it's not like I'm right. It was just a choice. We just had different ways of that we wanted to do this. And I've done this, you know, Bobcat, like you put me on the air with you almost 30 years ago when I was doing promotions at the Fan when you were doing the mornings. And, you know, even from back then, I was very clear-eyed about what this business is. So I was never surprised. And I think one of the best parts about being in the US as much as I have been, you have shows and don't have shows all the time. It's a very natural part of the industry. Only in Canada does it become this crazy news story. But I'm like, no, this is just how the shows work. Some of my favorite people have had 9 shows in their careers, and sometimes they chose the end, sometimes they didn't. That's just the business. So I've always approached this that way.
Well, but that also speaks of the microscope of hockey in our country. More than anything else. I mean, the iconic level that is, was, and to an extent still is the hockey night in Canada. Based on just listening to you, and you and I haven't ever talked about this, I almost think that you were 10 years ahead of yourself. I mean, if you could be the host of Hockey Night in Canada tomorrow, I think there'd be a greater acceptance inside the building and out.
I'll go one step further, John, and I've not told this to anybody, but because I have such a mountain of respect for both you guys, I'll tell you the story. So when they offered me the show, here's what I told them. Here's exactly what I told them. I said, I'll do it. Here's the plan. Let Ron do the early game. Give me the late game. Let me do it with Merrick. Let me build a team around the late game. Let me build a culture in the late game. Ron is a legend. Let Ron do the early game. Everybody on that side said, no, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it. And I said, guys, because here's the one thing, and I say this with love and respect to most sports TV people, less so radio, but more sports TV people. The one thing that most sports TV people who come from cable don't really understand is they don't understand Canada. They don't understand that an important broadcast is actually about building an emotional and intellectual railroad across the country. Most cable sports people don't understand that. But having my experience at CBC, your experience at CBC, previously my experience at Much Music, I understood, hey, there's a way to do this. When they did that video, which I was a part of, and it was one of the reasons that I realized this isn't going to work, bragging about the money they spent on the set, I thought, what a mistake. Yeah. What, talk about not understand, not being able to read the room. So, Bob, when I say that I didn't see it coming, I did see it coming because I knew early on that those markers you're looking for, if something's going to be a success, weren't there. And John, I said to them, let Ron do the early game. I'll do the late game. Trust me, because Ron, I understand Ron's, this is going to be difficult. I get all this. I've done this, right? I know how this is going to work. So let me earn the spot, even though as a host, I don't have to prove my wares, because as a host, I can do this. But let me earn the thing. They said, no way. So whenever I ended up leaving, and then they did that. Ron got the early game. I was like, you guys didn't get it. That I didn't just say it for out of nowhere. I'm very strategic about this. I know how this can work. And so I did plan that early. So definitely we were ahead of our time.
I will tell you one story because I don't think people, and perhaps it's changed now, but I don't think people understand the difference of working for the CBC than working for private broadcasters. And the role the CBC plays and the attitude the CBC has, there's a greater inclusiveness at the CBC. And on a Saturday night, I had hired a young guy who was a producer, a really good producer, still is a great producer, had come from TSN and was doing his first Saturday night game for us at the Montreal, at the Bell Center, had just moved. We'd moved over the new building. And halfway through the second period, he did something that, to me, was just like, how could you do that? And I picked up the phone to him and I said, hey, listen, Paul, I don't know what you're doing, but this ain't cable TV anymore. You're in the big leagues. At which, and now we're still friends and we laugh about it about every 3 or 4 months when we say, hey, listen, you're now at a network level. And that's the difference.
This is for the people.
That's right. That's right. And that's what, and you were taught that at the CBC. You were taught a lot of things at the CBC.
For sure. And I learned it even earlier at Much Music, whereas at Much Music, I understood what young people, you know, I understood how to reach people who didn't feel reached. You know, what's interesting that never came out, because I know in all those stories, when I became the host, all these stories were being, and I know those stories, how they got to the newspapers.
It was all about the pants, George. George, it was all about the pants.
Listen, anybody who criticized my pants, I don't value their opinions in the first place. But here's what the people told me at Hockey Night in Canada when I was the host. Here's what they told me directly. The ratings were going up when I was the host with people under 30 and with women. The ratings were going up with people under 30, which is what I was there to do, to grow the game. And so the ratings were going up, but that stuff never got written about. And again, I don't worry about it now because I like what I do. And my time in sports and hockey is not over by a long shot, right? So there's still plenty in the works. But I knew that I was doing a version of the right thing at the time. Were we ahead of our time? I'll say this. I don't think we were ahead of our time. I think they were just that far behind.
So there you go. Some of the best of the Bob McCowan podcast from the past 12 months as we take a little vacation here, much well, to the chagrin of the audience, I'm sure.
Well, not much of a vacation when you think of what's going on in the world, Bob. I'm still, but you know what? It's a good time to spend your family. Good time to have some quiet time. Enjoy some eggnog and some festive spirit.
Happy holidays to y'all from John and I. And we'll see you in the first week of January. Goodbye, everybody.